You're listening to the Experience Points Podcast, episode number 179 for the week of July 11th, 2012.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Experience Points Podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
And I'm George Albor.
We're the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net, a website we created and dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of video games and culture. And last week, thanks to the magic of technology, we brought you a podcast that we didn't even record last week.
Oh my gosh, yeah, time travel.
Yep. It's because I was gallivanting around in the good old capital of the U.S. of A., George.
New York? Is that it?
No, well, that would have been the capital if that was back in, you know, Assassin's Creed times. I was in Washington, D.C.
Hanging out with your good friend, Mr. Obama.
Yep. Barry, I call him. I was there doing the touristy thing, essentially, seeing all the sites, one of which is the Art of Video Games exhibition at one of the Smithsonian galleries that they have downtown in the city. I guess for those folks that are outside of the States, the Smithsonian it's actually a group of museums, basically, but it's a huge museum institution that has various, like, there's a natural history one, there's an American history one, there's art museums, there's a zoo, like, it's just a massive, largely taxpayer-funded museum organization.
And it's some of the best content in the world in terms of just collection of things to look at.
Right. Like, they have the Hope Diamond there, like, it's just... Right. Yeah.
Also known as the Diamond from Titanic. They have the Aeronautics Museum, which is super interesting for sort of the history of space travel.
Right. Mm-hmm. And terrestrial travel, too. Like, they have, you know, models and like, artifacts from the Wright brothers and stuff. It's, yeah.
That television show Bones is set in one of the Smithsonian labs.
Man, you mean you're telling me I could have seen David... Well, they probably film it in Canada, right? Because it's on television.
I mean, I'm presuming.
But, you know, we actually talked about the Art of Video Games exhibit, like, months ago when they first announced the games that they were going to show in this exhibit.
Oh, yeah, there's a huge list of games available.
Yeah, and the weird thing about them was that many of them, most of them, were subject to a voting process after the initial curatorial cut, basically. Like, there was, you know, several... Oh, I guess there was, like, over 100... Really, and then people started voting on which ones they wanted to see featured. Additionally, there were some other ones as well that were not subject to the voting process. But I gotta say, just straight off the bat, it was really surreal going into... It was the American Art Museum was where it was held, the galleries. And it was really surreal going into the same building to, like, go to a video game exhibit that holds, like... the famous presidential portraits, or like Andy Warhol stuff, or, you know, any one of a number of really famous works of art. Mm-hmm. And then, like, down the hallway, you start to hear, like, the Pac-Man music.
I'm going to have a load of questions for you, Scott, since I didn't actually go myself.
Right.
I am an avid museum goer, though.
You're a museumer?
Is that... I don't know what we're called, but we exist. And we enjoy museums. So why don't you start off this conversation with telling us a little bit about what it was like going in the very beginning. Like, how was the exhibit, I guess, curated, but specifically the space? Are they just arcade cabinets sitting on the floor with a little sign next to it? Are there queues?
You know, the entire exhibit was basically three galleries, one gallery per room. So it's a three-room thing. And the first room... you walk into is the largest because it has a somewhat like set along the walls. There's a pretty much linear path of consoles, chronologically organized.
So it's in the date that the console came out.
Right. Exactly. Okay. So, like, you start at one end, like, the room is a, you know, basically a square or a rectangle, and you start in one corner where there's, like, the Atari and the ColecoVision and the Intellivision, and then you follow it along the wall, and then you get to, like, the Commodore 64 and the NES, and you continue around the perimeter of the room until you loop back around with, like, the Xbox 360 and the PS3.
So the Xbox 360 is technically in the same room as the Atari 2600?
Right. Everything's in the same room, which is cool because it makes a nice transition as you're walking around. You can take a look at things, you know, what the controllers look like, what the consoles look like. And then above the, or to the side of the consoles, there's a screen with four buttons below it. And the buttons each correspond to a particular game highlighted that was featured on that console.
Mm-hmm.
And so you press the button to see video and hear a short narration of explaining that game, the significance of that game, and
you know,
stuff like that. And it's interesting because the games are divided up into genres that were basically made by the exhibit itself.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the genres they use are action, and so, like, some examples are, like, Pac-Man falls into the action genre, or I don't know what else. Super Mario Brothers 3 was in the action genre.
Marble Madness.
Right. And so there's the target. The target genre I like the most because it was a really elegant way of encompassing things that you have to aim at but don't necessarily shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Like Flower was in the target genre.
Oh, interesting.
Which I thought was kind of cool because it is essentially a target game. Like, you're targeting various things and trying to make those marks, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'd probably call it an action game, but all right.
I mean, the distinction was made, I think, because most target games take their cue from Space Invaders, which was, like, the target game that was on the Atari. Then there's Adventure, and the Adventure game is basically dominated by... It's not. It's weird because adventure encompasses things like adventure games, like, you know, Maniac Mansion or something, and also something like Legend of Zelda.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, it's a weird amalgamation of adventure and also tactics, which is more strategy type games. And so they had those four categories for each of the consoles that they featured.
In terms of the setup, was it easy to compare the games? I mean, what could you hold? Could you hold anything in your hand?
You couldn't hold stuff until you
no
got
touching,
to
then.
The, and that's why I can never go back to Washington D.C. You couldn't. There was a room at the end where they had, like, hands-on demos, basically.
Mm.
But the first room of the museum was set up much like a portrait gallery or a modern art gallery where you're watching short films or something like that.
Right.
So what you could touch is the buttons, basically, to show you the various other, you know, the various descriptions of the games. But it was looking only for this first room. But you could see everything, basically.
Well, how well do you think that lent itself to seeing the shape or and the change over time in the industry? Like, do you think that it was set up well, just geographically or spatially?
There was a little bit... It was a little weird because the room at a certain point got a bit segmented. Like, you could take a right when you should have taken a left, mm-hmm. and then things started seeming out of order. Like, it was really easy to jump straight from, like, the NES era stuff into...
Yeah, you took the warp whistle.
And then you warped back into, like, the N64. And at first I was like, wait, there should be a Genesis somewhere around here, you know? And so it's... kind of from a historical perspective, they could have been, I think, from a, like, a physical historical perspective, they could have been stricter about really guiding you.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was fairly well labeled. So if you're paying attention, you could see, like, on the perimeter of the room, there's things on the walls telling you, you know, what year and what genres you're looking at.
Yeah.
So it took a little bit of work, but you could easily bounce around, basically.
Some of the Smithsonian exhibits from other museums, I recall being, I don't know if artistic is the right word, but, like, really actively designed. Like, the exhibits in the Wright Brothers exhibit, for example, shows, you know, there are planes that look like they're in mid-flight going through the room.
Yeah.
Was there any sort of artistic flourish to the games?
It was pretty minimalistic. I mean, they really went for, like, a almost a Tron-like atmosphere, like a lot of blue lights, a lot of blank walls, you know.
Completely like, black.
It was like, there was not supposed to be anything that was, like, in the main, like, in the gallery room, there was nothing to distract you from the screens or the glass enclosures that held the consoles. It was, like, really focused on what was being displayed rather than kind of building an atmosphere, I guess.
Yeah. It's weird, because I feel like you miss a lot by not... If you can't play the game, I feel like to some extent you should create an air or an atmosphere that at least implies some movement through space. You know, like, that's sort of what games are about, fundamentally, or decision-making, or some way to get across the sense that there's an interactivity in this art form. Do you feel like they did a decent job of conveying that, at least in the narration, or do you think that it was a missed opportunity, or do you like the fact that it was so sparse?
I mean, I think, like, the first room was definitely the most challenging, and I think the weakest in a way because of the issues that you raise. I mean, you couldn't touch anything, and so you really had to rely on the narration of, of what these games were and why they were important. And for, I mean, you know, I don't know. I hate sounding pretentious, but for experts like you and me, you start to quickly pick holes in whatever is put out in front of you when you know about it, you know? So it's like, I clicked on the exhibit for Shenmue, and they didn't really mention that this was the game that is essentially responsible for the rise of the QuickTime event.
Right.
Like, it coined the term QuickTime event, and, like, the QuickTime event is a really important thing in the medium.
Yeah, that seems kind of like a large oversight.
Right, and I know where it comes from, because this room was dedicated to, like, trying to please everyone that voted on these things, which in and of itself is kind of a questionable choice after I've seen the exhibit, and to please people that have no idea what Shenmue is. You know, so, like, they have to kind of describe what the game was in terms of a story, and, like, the plot, you know, what the game is, like, what console it was, you know, when it came out and so forth. And so they had to make some tough decisions about what to talk about. And I think my natural bias is that I want to know about the actual game elements of it, rather than, you know, the visual art of it or something like that.
Did they get any designer interviews or any insight from those who made it?
Well, there were designer interviews, but they were not necessarily connected to any particular games.
Oh, I see.
So they had, you know, they had interviews on other screens throughout the exhibit with people like Genova Chen or Jesse Schell, or, you know, just other well-known game designers and are outspoken game designers.
Right, right. It's such a weird place to be, because even the oldest game there, like, a lot of the designers who worked on it are still alive, and they're still making games, in fact.
Yeah, pretty much every designer that, you know, every notable designer is still alive.
It's weird, because I can't help but see the way that you're describing it, at least, sounds like the way you might curate maybe the history of the printing press exhibit.
Right.
You know? As opposed to something that's a bit more modern art, which is, you know, video games are modern art. Like, and you go into the MoMA and you're going to have art exhibits that are getting in your way and being obnoxious and claiming space or messing with things in a really weird way. And that's partially the type of postmodern art that is being developed. But I feel like there could have been something really cool here, considering the fact that it is such a fresh medium.
Well, and that's the trap. You know, that it's almost unavoidable for the curators here, because you could easily do a printing press style exhibit. I mean, it's like, this is the first Pong console. It was designed this time, and here's how it worked electronically. Here's a cross section of the NES. Mm-hmm. Here's the lockout chip that they used as DRM. You know, like, you could really get into the mechanics of the technology, or you could get into, like you were saying, the more artistic side and, like, the vibe of what a video game is.
Yeah.
And, like, Hannah was with me, my wife, and she was saying that it's almost the equivalent of, you know, you would never create an exhibit that was like the art of oil painting, or no, just like the art of painting.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like, it's like, it's weird to have, like, a gallery that has to take on the challenge of explaining an entire creative medium.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, this is sculpture.
Yeah, but then you get things like in London, the Portrait Gallery, mm-hmm. which is all dedicated to just portraits of individuals. I guess in that case, that would be a bit more akin to what Hanna was thinking in terms of maybe the history of the platformer.
Exactly. This is the first-person shooter, you know? Yeah. And so they had this really immense challenge of, like, and it's already impressive that they were able to eke out as much floor space as they did, but, like, then to have the mandate of, like, representing video games.
Yeah.
Which is, I'm sure, one of the... Yeah, it is. And, like, especially in that gallery, I really started to question the wisdom of letting the crowd pick many of the games that ended up in there. Mm-hmm. Because you just end up with some strange choices, like choices that are popular but not necessarily that influential.
Yeah.
You know, like, there was no Mortal Kombat anywhere. There was no, like, the Sonic game that was represented was Sonic on the Dreamcast, not on the Genesis.
Right.
Which is, like, the Sonic on the Dreamcast was far less important than the Sonic on the Genesis was.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, like, that's where you really need, like, a curatorial hand in it, and it's where a popularity contest starts to kind of shift the mission away from history and more towards, like, popular reception of the games, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I can't help but feel that somewhat because it's an interactive medium and they want to be able to claim that these are in here because people found value in it as a way to sort of justify mm-hmm. the place in the museum in the first place, mm-hmm. As well as it's just the sort of modern thing to do. You know, like, let's ask the public and find out what they think.
Right.
You know, in the National Gallery in London, there's a painting that was voted upon as, like, the best painting according to the British or what have you. But it's not given some special place because people voted for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, we all know gamers are unusually opinionated. And so I think it's a smart move to, like,
involve people. That was a very tactful way to say that, Scott.
I mean, you know, we know what we like, and we like it a lot.
Yeah.
And so I totally understand where that comes from. It's just, it's interesting to see it function. And, you know, you start to raise questions of what is the function of a museum? You know, is it to, like, represent things that are popular? Is it to gather things just for saving them? Is it to let cultural elites kind of be the arbiters of what should and shouldn't be considered important? You know, it's like a little
microcosm. That's an ongoing conversation.
It is, and it's interesting to see it played out in the newest of mediums.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
You know, it's like, it's the same old problems over and over again, just, you know, in a different space.
So another thing I thought was interesting is you said it was in the American Art Museum.
Right.
But not all of these games were made in America or exclusively by Americans.
I think it was the PlayStation. It was, like, three Square Enix games, like, a couple Final Fantasies and like, Metal Gear Solid. Like, none of them were American.
So how was that represented? Did they discuss the international...
I mean, there wasn't... The industrial side of things was almost non-existent. Mm. Like, there was no talk of, you know, the sales wars or no talk of lawsuits or anything like that. I mean, it was very much focused on the art and, you know, divorced from the capitalistic origins of the medium. What they did have is, you know, they had the designers and the companies, so you got to see who was lead or who was producer on the games. And so, you know, if you were looking carefully, you would see, oh, like, clearly these people are all Japanese.
Right.
But there wasn't, like, it brings up another kind of contemporary issue of, like, how to treat more transnational media.
Yeah.
Because
especially in an American art museum,
and it's like, where else? I started to think, like, where would you put this then? Because a lot of museums organize themselves along nation state or at least regional lines.
Well, there's some museums that are like Museum of Science and Technology,
right? Which are, you know, those are the exceptions, but they're not doing the same thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Like if you go to any. Like you were saying, in London or whatever, like, here's the Egypt place, here's the Greece place, here's the Italy place. And it's like, where would you then put this stuff?
I mean, that's why it's got to be curated in the way that a modern art museum is curated.
Yeah. And it's telling that it was closer in the grander museum. It was very close to the modern art section. Like you stepped out of the video game section and then there was like some crazy, like, 30-foot-high wall of televisions all playing dissonant noise or whatever. It's like, okay, yeah. Well, I kind of know where they're going with it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's other rooms in it. So that's, like, the gallery room.
Oh, okay. Oh, man. Sorry, I interrupted you and we went on a huge thing. Go ahead.
No, no, like, it's the biggest room, and it has the most content in it. But there's also, there was a middle room that was kind of, I call it, like, the cool-out room, because it has, like, a bench in it and some other places to sit, because you've just been standing for a good long while watching all these games.
And you just sit and watch, like, a five-hour cinematic by Square Enix?
you watch cinematics of Warren Spector talking about, like, imbuing pixels with story in order to create meaning, which was pretty interesting. So there's like a Warren Spector interview, there was a Genova Chen interview that was brilliant and insightful as usual. there's a couple other, there's some cool concept art from a few different games. There's some Bethesda concept art from the, gosh, this is too bad, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but it was the guy who recently passed away who did a lot of the Elder Scrolls art. And then there's a couple really boss pictures of Solid Snake from Konami, and you know, there was other placards around the room kind of describing the design process. And then the nice thing about that is that it then leads you into my favorite room, which was a completely curated room of hands-on games that you could play.
Okay. And what was included in this lot?
You could play Pac-Man, the original Pac-Man, you know, the arcade version, Super Mario Brothers for the NES.
Miss Pac-Man's way better. They should have put that in there.
Well, I mean, I think they wanted, I don't know. I have some, we'll talk about the Pac-Man versus, because there's a couple other Pac-Man issues I had with the whole exhibit.
All right.
Like, so Super Mario Brothers, Myst for the PC.
Okay, which, that's an interesting decision.
It is an interesting decision, but I like it. The Secret of Monkey Island.
Okay.
And Flower. And all those games you could play, and they have them set up with, like, timed demos usually.
Yeah.
As you might guess, the Myst demo, just pretty much as rough as playing Myst in real life, as I recall.
Like, I'm not surprised. The reason I think they put that there is it's still one of the most widely played games by people who played it and then never played another game in their life.
Right.
Like, when I have conversations with random people about video games, they will almost always mention Myst.
Yeah, and I think that's, I was glad to see that in there, and I don't think it's a mistake that this is, like, the completely curated section. Like, the designers of the exhibit put these in here without any fan input, and I don't think Myst would have really fit in anywhere else in the exhibit.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, I think Myst is a really important, pop culturally important game, because people who didn't play video games still played Myst.
Did they have more than one console and television per generation? Were there lines?
No, there were. It wasn't too crowded, so it was mostly like groups of people watching. Usually, people were pretty good about letting younger people play and then watching, because they had it projected on bigger screens.
That's so interesting. I almost feel like it's more important for older people to play.
Well, this is my favorite room, because I quickly noticed that the general breakdown of people that were in this gallery were youngish parents of kids that were toting around cranky kids.
Oh, wow.
And so these were people that had grown up in, like, the 80s and 90s and now had some kids that were, like, you know, child age, like, above 5 but less than 13, you know?
And these kids are incredibly good at Portal and have no idea what Monkey Island was or Super Mario Brothers.
Exactly. Han and I were sitting there watching the Super Mario Brothers console, and there's these two kids, brothers, I gather from overhearing the conversation.
And the green and red outfits they were wearing.
Mustaches. They picked up the NES controller and just proceeded to just fail miserably. They did not even get the first Goomba in level 1-1 of Mario. Killed them just straight away, like 3 times in a row. They couldn't do anything about it.
And that's when the parents were like, oh my god, we're leaving.
No, well, then the dad stepped in and, you know, reloaded the game and proceeded to flawlessly complete World 1-1 of Super Mario Brothers.
Awesome.
To the point where he got up to the flagpole and kind of hung off the edge of that mountain like halfway in order to create a running jump to get 5,000 points for the flagpole.
Oh my God, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Wait, so it's because our generation, we have that level memorized.
Right. And he was laughing after that. He was like, oh, you know, I used to play, I remember playing this game. I played this game a lot. And then, like, he just didn't die one time. He was, and, like, you can tell he didn't remember some parts. Like, he was testing which pipe he could go down to warp and everything. But yeah, he remembered that you could, that some pipes you could go down.
Yeah.
And so, like, he just blasted through the level and then was kind of showing his kids how to play it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, this is what you do. This is what this thing does. And then I went over to the Pac-Man console, and then there was this little girl playing it, and her mom was there, like, taking pictures of her, like, using the joystick and stuff.
Yeah.
And while she was doing that, she was like, okay, honey, what you need to do is get that pellet, and then once the ghosts come next to you, then you can eat them. Okay, hurry up, they're starting to flash, you gotta chase them now, you know, like, she was, like, teaching this kid how to play Pac-Man.
Right.
And so, like, this room was full of people that had, like, grown up with these like foundational experiences that their kids just didn't have.
Yeah.
But since they're still alive and the games are still playable, you can have this transferal of knowledge that is more than just a museum, you know? Yeah. Like, we can't learn anything about the Wright brothers except if it's from a museum or a historian.
Right.
Like, but that if we could cultural get in a plane. Knowledge is dead.
Yeah.
If we can get from a plane, or if we could hear someone who was there at Kitty Hawk.
Yeah.
You know, like, we're lucky. It just made me realize that we are currently in the era where the people who were there at the beginning are still alive and able to pass along, like, the cultural knowledge completely, you know, directly to their kids.
Yeah. Were the kids receptive to that, did it look like?
I mean, once they knew, you know, they started practicing, they, you know, they started, like, getting better at it and understanding what was going on. Like, the thing that I also realized was that the older games especially didn't really have any tutorials. So the idea of passing along, like, how did you learn how to play Super Mario? Like, there's a lot of trial and error, obviously, but there's also a lot of cultural learning that you were trading tips with your friends. You were, like, reading things in magazines and stuff. Like,
right.
Older games, you needed more outside of game knowledge in order to really master them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a whole section of the medium that the museum just happened to spring up on organically.
Yeah.
You know, like, the idea of how our knowledge of games is transmitted was done by this room, but not necessarily intentionally. They just wanted you to let you play some games. Right. But it kind of unintentionally showcased how games functioned, you know, as a culture, and especially in those earlier days.
Do you think it would have been better if the whole exhibit had just been that?
I mean, I think it, in a perfect world, probably, because, you know, it's hard to really, it's hard to watch something like Sonic and really get the feel of it.
Plus, the information is not mutually exclusive. You could theoretically read something about the game and then play it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing is that, you know, one of the things that stood out to me is that the games that were violent, where the violence was kind of at a bare minimum. Like, there was one of the games, I guess, for the 360 was BioShock, and they never showed any on-screen deaths. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, well, that's a pretty huge misrepresentation of what BioShock is, because it's at its core, it's essentially a game about bludgeoning dudes to death with a wrench.
Yeah,
you know?
Like, yeah.
It's kind of, it's whitewashing in a way, you know?
And that violence is intimately connected to the narrative as well.
Right. There's this really good picture that Hannah took of, I don't know, maybe she's like a seven or eight-year-old staring at the screen of BioShock with headphones on. Mm-hmm. And she just looks like a little sister.
She's wearing a blue dress.
Like, whispering to her. I was like, take a picture of the little sister. Trying to be creepy, but take a picture of her.
Oh, man. Okay, well, We're getting close to the end, but there's a couple more things I want to hit on.
Yeah, go for it.
What were the demographics like? For the most part, museums are visited by, more often than not, middle-aged to elderly white individuals.
Yeah.
Same?
It skewed younger. Mm-hmm. And it skewed more popular. Like, there were more people in this exhibit than many of the... There were more people in this exhibit than there were in the Presidential Gallery exhibit that was in the same museum.
And do you think it's partially because it's just... It's fresh? It's an interesting idea?
I think that's definitely one reason. And, right. You know, the other thing is that the people were younger. Like, there were some people that were our age there. There were definitely some young parents, like people in their probably early 40s or so.
Right.
That clearly had grown up with these games and now had kids that may have a passing interest in games or games that they kind of wanted to, you know. There was a lot of people I overheard so many times in the gallery, like, oh, remember when we got our Atari? Oh man, look how funny that looks now, you know, like that sort of thing. So there's kind of this like living, there's this living nostalgia, you know, like a nostalgia for something that isn't quite gone but is almost gone. And there's also a fair number of non-white folks there.
Oh, good.
Which I was kind of interested in because, you know, a lot of those, like you were saying, a lot of those museums, especially the historical ones and the Eurocentric historical ones especially, are predominantly white folks.
Right.
But it was a fairly diverse crowd of people, which I thought was pretty heartening. And, you know, like I said, it's always heartening to see a lively museum because many of those galleries you walk through and no one's there.
Yeah. Within those demographics, what percentage of those people do you think were non-gamers, like not familiar with games at all? And of those individuals, and I don't know, maybe this is just something I do, but I like to listen in on other people's conversations now and again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What was their response, if you could glean any, from those individuals in particular?
I mean, it's pretty hard because I don't think anyone in the gallery was completely unfamiliar with games. Mm-hmm. Like, the most I heard was people talking about, you know, things like, oh, I think we had a Genesis. Like, was that a Genesis that we had in our house? Do you remember that? Like, you know, people that are kind of a passing familiarity with it.
Right.
And then maybe lost touch. Like, I saw there was a pretty cool scene where a young kid, pretty young, maybe like 5 or 6, was playing Flower, and someone who looked like a dad or uncle was kind of standing behind him watching. And clearly that guy had never seen Flower before. And was pretty impressed with what was going on.
Awesome.
And like telling the son, like, oh, you know, what's that thing? What does that do? Or like, oh, look, it's lighting up this light. We should follow this, you know, that sort of thing. But I'm not sure how many people didn't have any you know, knowledge of games going in there.
So you saw neither people openly weeping or those... Or those promising to rekindle their passion for games?
It's just someone smashed the glass like, this is my Intellivision.
What have I missed?
I mean, it is neat to see that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, to see how quickly things change, especially like kind of in the 90s. Like, you have things that look like the Super Nintendo, and then a few years later you have things that look like the Dreamcast. Mm-hmm. And so if you're paying attention, you'll see those types of things. But it's like visually, it's very good. Like, I think this is like a good starting point, but the next, like, the goal now is to get specific, you know, like an exhibition about the rise of strategy games, or an exhibition about the technical limitations of certain types of games or something, you know?
Yeah. Or even specific designers.
Right. Like, this is the collected work of Will Wright.
Right.
You know, something like that.
Right. I mean,
right. We all have to get him to, like, you know, donate. I'm sure, like, that, and that's the thing that I started thinking about. Like, I'm sure these designers have, you know, massive collections of notes and old demos that never saw the light of day. Like, remember, like, Jordan Mechner just recently found the source code of Prince of Persia.
Yeah.
And it was like sitting in a shoebox somewhere in like his parents' closet. And it's,
and
like
some of those animation videos too.
Yeah, like he was like capture, like, you know, doing animation research with his brother, like jumping and stuff like that. Like, it's that kind of stuff. Like, the kind of the ephemera around games is also in need of preservation too.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine if we got a hold of, like, Miyamoto's notebooks?
Oh, man.
So it's like, it's like, this is like a first step, and it feels, in some ways, it feels so simplistic and so kind of rudimentary, but it's really, it's the only place you could start, you know?
Yeah, it makes sense. I'm looking forward to see what comes next, though.
Yeah.
Kickstarter campaign. Scott and George's Museum of Video Games.
We'll invade one of the Smithsonian museums.
One last question.
Yeah.
It sounds like it was a mixed bag, and I think it has to be a mixed bag. I think you would agree. If you could change one thing at the exhibit, what would it be?
Oh, man. Well, I guess it would have to be... It'd have to be a better discussion of how the games... Like, how the systems work to make the games unique.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not just... This isn't just... Like, Metal Gear Solid 2 isn't just unique because it looked really interesting. Like, how did that level of realism change the way the game functioned?
Mm-hmm. So the relationship between hardware and design.
Right. And that stuff is hard to do because you either have to be really observant or you have to really force people down a specific path. Like, you need to have a docent there that's just demoing the game or something. But it's like, the important thing is... Not only were all the little glasses and watermelons on the shelf of Metal Gear Solid 2 discrete objects, like, the point was, you know, that impacted gameplay.
Right.
And so it's like, that is both an aesthetic thing, but it also served the game system and how the game communicated things to you. And so, you know, you either need to have someone really play that game for a long time, or you need to have, you know, like, the equivalent of those... of the old ladies that are in every museum that guide people around, but, yeah, you know, with controllers, basically.
Yeah.
And so it's like either hands-on stuff or very guided things about why games are actually different rather than something that, oh, look at these wacky computer paintings, you know?
Yeah.
Like, one of Genova Chen, like, one of the things Genova Chen said in the interview, in the videotaped interviews, was that you can't explore a painting in the same way you can explore a video game.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it was one of the most succinct things that, you know, was said in the entire exhibit as to why games are different. Like, you can have a different experience and an adventure, and the system enables you to make an interpretation that a static piece of art can't do.
Right.
And it's like,
it responds to you in that way.
Right. And you have to explore it. You have to actively take an interest in exploring the world. And it's like, yeah, that's completely correct. And it's hard to communicate that if people aren't explicitly told, or if they can't find that out for themselves.
Yeah. Interesting.
Maybe they could just get Genova Chen to, like, hang out in that gallery.
I like that. You know, one day I feel comfortable that all of the designers and old critics will be able to work at museums. Those tour guides.
Yeah, we'll put on fanny packs.
That's sort of what you do, right? Once you reach the age of, like, 70.
I mean, it's funny because that's what, like, if you go to, you know, Monticello, or if you go to any of the other museums, like, there are old senior citizen volunteers, and, like, that will be us someday. We'll have our, like, DualShocks in hand, like, let me tell you about flowers, Sonny. Like,
I'd do it. I'd sign up.
Yeah, and I think if this takes off, that will benefit it because, you know, people are enthusiastic and they will want to show things off.
Yeah.
So if this comes to you, I would say, you know, think about volunteering, you know?
Yeah. I mean, maybe the large number of visitors was just because it was so hot in DC.
It was hot.
But I'm hoping that it's a good sign there were plenty of people in there.
Yeah, it was. But yeah, it's so who says museums are all stuffy and boring and stuff? There's plenty of SimCity to be played.
Yeah.
All right, so I guess we'll wrap it up there. I mean, there's plenty of things that we didn't talk about.
Yeah.
So if you have any questions, comments, anything about the podcast, experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And I'm sure there's some DC listeners, right?
I'm sure there are.
It's a free museum, correct?
Oh, yeah. I mean, most of the Smithsonians are completely free, and you should definitely make use of it if you're anywhere in the area.
And if you are in the area and you did pay to visit, let us know in the comment section to this podcast. We'd love to hear your thoughts about it. What's so funny?
Because you said if you paid... I thought you said if you did pay to visit. I was going to say, well, then you got ripped off, son. Uncle Sam is scamming you.
Unfortunately, you got scammed. ExperiencePoints.net is the website. Come on down and bring your friends. It's nice and cool inside. So.
It is. There's air conditioning. All right. Until next time, everyone. Thanks for listening. Take it easy. Bye-bye.